This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. After 13 riders were eliminated from the Tour de France before it began because they'd been implicated in a Spanish doping investigation, the last thing cycling's premier event needed was suspicion about the winner. But that suspicion surfaced on Thursday when the A sample on a routine test conducted on Floyd Landis after stage 17 of the race indicated an unusually high level of testosterone. Landis is now waiting for the results of the B sample. Joining me now to help shed some light on these circumstances is Steve Madden, the editor and chief of Bicycling Magazine. Steve, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill.
To begin with, what does a test for elevated levels of testosterone indicate?
Well, it could indicate the fact that there's been an external source of testosterone. In other words, that the athlete has taken supplementary testosterone to help his performance.
In his press conference yesterday, Floyd Landis said two things. One, I normally have an elevated level of testosterone. And two, I was surprised when the test came back showing an elevated level of testosterone. How do both of those things exist?
I don't know. And there's an awful lot about this that we don't know. I mean, part of the problem here is that according to the rules of the game, you know, as described by the UCI, the governing body of cycling, you give a sample, and Floyd gave seven samples. He was pulled into doping control seven times during the tour.
Mm-hmm.
He gives a sample of either urine or blood, depending on what they're looking for that day. In this case, it was urine. That gets broken down into an A sample and a B sample. They test the A sample. If it is suspicious, they have to test the B sample. And only when both the A and the B sample come back positive is there a positive drug test.
Hmm.
What's happened is his A sample has been tested. His B sample has yet to be tested. So according to the rules of the game, he hasn't tested positive for anything. But because of the strange place that cycling finds itself in the summer of 2006, the UCI announced these results. They told Floyd's team and his national governing body, and the word got out pretty quickly. And he's being condemned right now for something that technically he's not guilty of until the B sample results come back next week.
Various explanations have been offered for the test result. Landis gets cortisone injections for his damaged hip. He says he's been taking thyroid medicine for about 2 years. He apparently drank beer and whiskey on the night between stage 16 and stage 17 of the tour, which I gather is unusual. Any explanation anywhere in there for elevated testosterone?
I like the beer and the whiskey explanation myself because it finally explains to me after 42 years why people get in bar fights. You know, there are several studies that show that having some drinks would raise your testosterone level. And these studies popped up really quickly yesterday. There are at least five of them.
Mm.
But the levels of alcohol that you have to drink to raise your level of testosterone significantly are pretty intense.
Phonak, the team for which Floyd Landis rides, has said that they do not test to determine testosterone levels in their riders. Why not? Wouldn't a test have indicated that Landis is correct? He has a higher than normal level every day?
That's one of many things that just don't add up here. It seems like if this is something that you're going to be tested for during the month of July, you'd be testing for it every month of the year. Testosterone, it's not typically a big problem in cycling because it does add muscle mass, and these guys don't always want it. Taken in low doses, it could speed up the recovery. But why they're not testing for this, I don't know. You can bet that every single Pro Tour team next year will be testing for testosterone levels.
And perhaps saying of their riders who have normally high levels, hey, don't worry about this guy, this is just the way he is.
It could be that, and they could also be making sure that there's no Jack Daniels on their training tables.
Floyd Landis has also said that no matter how this matter is resolved, even if it is eventually established that he broke no rules, used no banned substances, he will perhaps never entirely recover his reputation. Does that seem likely to you?
Yeah, he'll never live this down. I think that what I think is actually going to happen is that He'll get it overturned on a technicality, and he'll keep his title. As I said, this is something that a lot of different, the testosterone test is something that a lot of different athletes have had thrown out by the Court of Arbitration and Sport over the years. And if it comes to that, I think the same will happen for Floyd. But the damage is done. I mean, people are going to, especially people outside the cycling industry, will look at this guy and say, oh, he's damaged goods. That's the guy who cheated. He got off on a technicality. You know, within cycling, it's kind of a different story. But I feel for Floyd because this is a tremendous opportunity. You can see what Lance Armstrong was able to turn success in France into in the United States, and I just don't think that Floyd's going to get that same opportunity.
Steve, is it becoming more difficult to remain a fan of this sport?
I have to tell you that I watched Floyd's performance the day that he bounced back, and I was like a little kid. I was just so I was so excited. I was bouncing up and down, and 10 minutes after that stage was over, I was on my bike riding my favorite route to see how fast I could go. I wanted to sit down and write the editor's note for the magazine as a letter to my son Luke, telling him that anytime you feel like you can't get something right, go back and watch this DVD of Floyd Landis in the Alps. And then I stopped and thought, you know, maybe I shouldn't do that, because just the way things have been this year, it might not work out. The sort of salvation I have at the end of the day is the fact that the soul of cycling to me lives in the 8 million people who ride their bikes in the United States, not the 200 or so well-paid professionals who compete in races like the Tour de France. The pleasure and the benefit and everything is not going to be diminished for those people, and I'm one of them.
Steve Madden is the editor-in-chief of Bicycling Magazine. Steve, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
The Kansas City Royals aren't a bad baseball team. They are a terrible baseball team. They began the season by losing 11 of 12 games, and then, as if to demonstrate that the streak was no fluke, they ran it to 19 losses in 22 games. No team is nearly as far from first place as the Royals, who trail the Tigers in the American League Central Division by more than 30 games. When the Royals were in Boston last week to lose 3 in a row to the Red Sox, I asked Kansas City center fielder Joey Gathright how he and his teammates maintain a positive attitude, given that with more than 2 months to go in the season, they have no chance at all to finish over 500, let alone make the playoffs.
You want to win games no matter what. I mean, you don't get into this sport wanting to lose. So, I mean, towards the end of the year, you know you're going to be the team that could spoil, you know, the Red Sox or the Yankees' chances to get into the playoffs or have that number one seed or whatever. But right now, we're still thinking about winning games, so that's basically our main focus.
Okay, I said, but playing for a winner or a contender or at least a team that might have a shot at contention has to be more fun than playing for a last-place club, right?
I'm pretty sure it is. I haven't been there yet. I came from Tampa to here, so it's two last-place teams, but I'm pretty sure it is.
That must be a little tough. I mean, when you were in Tampa, you must have felt, well, it can't get any worse than last place.
Nah, you don't really think like that, man. We go out and have fun. We're in the big leagues. Why can't you have fun in the big leagues? Right? In last place or first place, you are bothered a little bit, but, you know, it's baseball. You're in the big leagues. Just go out and have fun. Be happy.
That's an attitude shared by Royals relief pitcher Joe Nelson, who has even more reason than Joey Gathright to be grateful for a job in the bigs, never mind the quality of the employer. Nelson, who's played for several different organizations, has bounced between Kansas City and its AAA farm team in Omaha 4 times during the past 2 summers.
I'll be honest, it's a great job, and I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. And even if you're on a team like the Royals who struggle, I want to be a part of where we turn it around. And that starts with one game, and it could be today's game.
It wasn't that day's game, which the Royals lost to Boston 5-4, nor was it the next day's game or the game on the day after that. Given the circumstances, I wondered if some of the Kansas City players had begun to think less about the team's prospects and more about their own statistics. Infielder Tony Graffanino said that wasn't the case.
I don't, strictly because any time I've ever started to focus on what I'm doing individually, I've usually gone in the tank. So it's not worth it, really. I think everybody will agree if you just go out there and, you know, do the things that you're asked to do, you know, by the end of the year, your numbers should be fine.
Whatever Tony Graffanino's numbers are at the end of the year, they'll appear on the stat summary of the Milwaukee Brewers, who acquired him from the Royals a few days ago. Going from a team that's 30 games out to a third-place club that can still see the taillights of the leaders in their division, Graffanino must feel as if he's been promoted. He may not be the only Royal to be rescued from the cellar before the trade deadline on Monday, at least according to Royals pitcher Joe Nelson.
We have some quality players that teams that are in contention are probably going to want to try to acquire, and with the trade deadline coming up, it's a daily thing. And as a player, you try not to think about stuff like that. Nobody's ever tried to acquire me at the deadline, but I'll bet we have some guys that teams are interested in getting.
Maybe so. In any case, whoever's left with the Royals when August begins will be trying to think not about yesterday, but about today and tomorrow and maybe the day after that. First base coach Brian Poldberg says encouraging that sort of forward-looking attitude in the clubhouse is part of his job.
We don't get beat. We beat ourselves, and we've gotten better. But it's just we're still, maybe a big hitter, a starting pitcher, a guy in the bullpen. Not far, but, it seems like a long way at times.
It's likely to seem like a long way for some time to come, at least according to Joe Posnanski, a sports columnist for the Kansas City Star.
It's not something they're going to turn around this year. It's something that you are talking about 2, 3, 4 years down the road when you're talking about a full-length turnaround. But what I think they would like to see are signs. And this has probably been the most depressing part of this season, is that there have been very, very few signs of hope.
Kansas City can at least dream that the installation of Dayton Moore as the team's general manager in June will help. Moore came from a winner, the Atlanta Braves, which has encouraged the Royals themselves and, to some extent, according to Joe Posnanski, their fans.
There's no question that the hiring of Dayton Moore as a general manager has energized the fan base a little bit. I think people are eager to see how it's going to go. I think people are willing to be patient and see if this direction changes. But if it doesn't change, I think that Kansas City is going to be a very, very depressed baseball town. They've been told for so many years it's going to get better, and it hasn't, and after a while you just stop listening.
The Royals will hope their fans are still listening and watching and perhaps even cheering when they play the Rangers tonight in Texas. It's 19 minutes. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a historian remembers a Negro League pioneer who won't be inducted into Cooperstown, and her name isn't Buck or even Effa. But first, William C. Roden, who's been writing the Sports of the Times column for the New York Times for more than a decade, is the author of a new book titled $40 Million Slaves, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of the Black Athlete. That a young man working under a contract paying him $40 million to play basketball could be considered a slave is a provocative notion. That's a circumstance Mr. Roden recognizes, since $40 million slaves was not the original title of the book he had in mind. William Roden joins me now from NPR West in Los Angeles. Mr. Roden, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, Bill. Thank you very much. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you. Tell us about the basketball fan who inadvertently gave you the title for your book.
That's a funny story. Well, it's funny now. You know, when the New York Knicks last played for the NBA championship in 1999, there's a guy named Larry Johnson, who's, one of the stars of the team. And, Larry had boycotted the media for most of the year. Anyway, the NBA fined him. He said, "You got to talk." So finally he said, "Okay, you want me to talk? I'm going to talk." And he kind of blasted just the media and the treatment. And once he pointed at the court and he said, "Those are my friends." He said, "You know what? We're a bunch of rebellious slaves on this team." So, of course, the next day, the media just killed him. "What do you mean, slave and blah, blah, blah?" Well, the next year, the Knicks were playing in Los Angeles. And during a timeout, as the Knicks, came back to the bench, this white fan stood up by the Knicks bench and said, "Johnson, you're nothing but a $40 million slave." And I found it very interesting, A, that the white fan remembered that and chose to heckle him. And then that Johnson chose that metaphor, and the fact that he would use that to make people understood how he felt, I found very, very, very compelling. Mm. And that would be a compelling way to begin a discussion.
Very early in $40 Million Slaves, you ask, I'm quoting now, who could possibly call these powerful, globe-straddling icons failures? And the reference is not only to basketball players such as LeBron James, but also to Michael Vick and to Tiger Woods. And you answer the question with, I do. Why?
This group, you know, when you, particularly when you go back in the history as I did, starting literally on the plantation, and now beginning to sort of work yourself through, and you see what everybody has sort of had to overcome just to get to this point. And now you've looked at athletes who've arrived at a point in history where they're making more money than ever before, more global acclaim than ever before. But the sad thing is that with all this potential wealth and all this potential power, there's no collective action, and they really still are on the periphery of power of an industry they created. I mean, you know, when you look beyond the field, if you walk through most of the team, you know, the team front offices, you know, you walk through advertising agencies that do a lot of their commercials, and you walk, I mean, there's no black presence there at all. Although individual people are doing some really good things, the kind of collective effort that has led to, you know, African-American survival over the years has really dissipated, and it's become more of a sort of a one-on-one thing. And we all know that you're really no stronger than the team.
Bill, you describe a mechanism you call the conveyor belt, which carries the very best athletes really from childhood to professional careers. How does this so-called conveyor belt diminish black athletes along the way?
I think a lot of what it really does, and it's a very subtle kind of brainwashing process, in that, you know, when you're on this belt, particularly in basketball and football, a young black kid often sees along the way, what you learn is that, what he may see is that, wow, all the people who've got power along the way in this conveyor belt, all the things that can make these big things happen are white. They run the Nike camp. They run this camp. They're, you know, they're the guys who can offer me money for doing this. And the way to get from point A to B is just kind of keep your mouth shut. Don't rock the boat. You know, the fact that maybe your athletic department has never had an African-American head coach, just forget it, just play ball, and you'll get the contract, you get the scholarship, and everything will be fine. And the conveyor belt not only takes kids at a young age and makes them fluent in their particular sport, but it also reinforces the message, you know, white people are in power, and what happens oftentimes is when it's time to get the contract, you know, and you need the financial advisor, you need the real estate agent, you need, you know, all the people who are there often don't look like you. And so, again, it gets back to this sort of black labor, white wealth thing, is that in your mind, you're, you know, you turn over all your stuff to people outside the community. It's just, you know, kind of the same thing as a dollar not circulating. And I guess the book is kind of saying, listen, guys, you know, we have to have a team meeting because enough is enough. I mean, we have to empower each other. It's not anti-white. I mean, it's not even about that. It's just simply about using all your force and all your power to empower your community.
One of the players who benefited most spectacularly from the conveyor belt and from the system at large, of course, is Michael Jordan, whom you characterize in $40 Million Slaves as, quote, apolitical. What might Jordan have done specifically that he didn't do when he was the most popular athlete and perhaps the most recognizable single person on the planet?
You know, but he could have called a meeting. He could have been not quite the same level as Dr. King, but when Dr. King called a rally, everybody came because of how they respected him. And Michael had that same type of pull. I mean, if he would have called a meeting of athletes, said, listen, we need to come together, whether it's we need to find a way to pool all of our energy and resources to do a bank, a hospital, or whatever. He could have just done so much more in terms of, you know, moving this entire culture of African Americans forward. I mean, I'll give you an example. In 1966, Jim Brown, who is, you know, clearly one of the great running backs of all time, he mobilized athletes across the board: Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Bill Russell. And they formed something called the Black Economic Development Union. And they also came out in public support of Muhammad Ali, who, you know, at the time was announced that he wasn't going to go to the war in Vietnam. That was a very powerful statement. You know, Michael Jordan couldn't have done that. People said, well, listen, that's just not his personality. You know, that's just not the way it was. But sometimes circumstances compel you to do things that aren't necessarily your personality. I'm sure that Dr. King's personality wouldn't necessarily put himself in a position where he'd get murdered. Sometimes circumstances compel you to go outside of yourself. And, you know, granted, that wasn't Michael's thing, but it could have been.
Let's get back to the plantation metaphor with which we began this discussion and which is also responsible for the title of the book. Assuming that black athletes still in 2006 are working on a figurative plantation, what has to be done to dismantle the plantation?
You buy it. You buy it. You pull your resources and you buy it. Yeah, because I think even on the plantation, one of the awful things about slavery, I mean, in addition to just the basic concept of people owning people, was that, you know, the bondsmen, the slaves weren't, they worked in the field, but they weren't really able to participate in the profit, you know? And I think now athletes, if they choose to exercise this power, are in a position to really fully profit, not just in terms of their wages, their salaries, but to profit in a way that deals with ownership, owning things, you know, getting beyond the black labor, white wealth metaphor. That's still very much in play now. And that's not obviously a literal plantation, but I think we're talking about removing those intellectual and emotional shackles.
Robert Johnson, the one African-American owner of a major league franchise, does not come in for a great deal of praise from you.
You know, Bob, you know, who I like and respect, will tell you, the first thing he'll say is, listen, I'm a capitalist. And a lot of people, including me, were really, really unhappy when, you know, Bob had built this great thing of BET, you know, the first national media exposure I got back in, like, you know, 83 or 84 was in BET.
Mm-hmm.
You know, me and Mike Wilbon and Brian Burwell and late Ralph Wiley, you know, we did a show, a great sports show. And in a world where, you know, African-American access to national media is minuscule, this was like a great oasis and we look forward to it. But when the time was right to sell it, you know, he sold it, you know, and sold it to a huge white corporation. So when he buys the Charlotte Bobcats, I'm like really happy and all that, but you just wonder, okay, where is this going to go? You know, what are we going to do here? You know, and again, it's Bob's freedom to do, you know, whatever he wants to do, but you just hope that ownership will mean something again for the African American community. It's, you know, dealing with a clothing manufacturer or something, but the track record suggests that whoever's got the dollars will be the one who gets the business.
I'm a little curious about how the two forces of capitalism and activism work together, because if the way to get rid of the plantation, the present situation, as you've described it, is to buy it, does that include an activist component? Do they also change it as well as buy it?
Ultimately, the way to salvation is not reform, but it's transformation. You know, reforming a corrupt system isn't really the solution. The problem you're going to have with real reform is that too many people, too many athletes, you know, they're living off this golden goose, and they're afraid that if they reform it too much, the golden goose is going to die. And that's probably why you really will not have true reform. But, you know, but you have to deal in the realm of idealism. In fact, as I was writing the book, you know, over the 8-year period, there are nights when I was just saying, you know, man, this is hopeless, you know, because the worst thing is to replace a corrupt system with another corrupt system. You know, you'd like to think that our history, and that's why you have to know the history, that after everything we've gone through, that there's a certain degree of enlightenment that accompanies you when you do assume power, that you understand how terrible it is when you're unfair, that when you lock people out, you know, that when people just denied opportunity, you know, that, yeah, that you want to be a sort of rainbow. You want to obviously help your people, but you just want to be fair. You want to have that level playing field.
Toward the end of the book, you say the finish line keeps moving. We have to understand that and sort of pursue our ideals and goals and redefine them as necessary, which I thought was a wise way of putting it.
Yeah, and there is no promised land. I think one of the things I finally realized, you like to think that, now this is a promised land. But there really isn't one promised land. It just keeps changing. And we're sort of on this existential errand, you know.
Hmm.
And that's why I guess maybe for African Americans, I think, has always been stamina. that you just have to just keep running.
Well, that's right. And also maybe it's one of the reasons why so many professional athletes, whether they're black or white or whoever they are, get to a certain point. They have a lot of money. They've bought the big house. They own a bunch of cars. And then they get themselves in trouble. And it's maybe because they don't really have any sense other than a kind of superficial sense of achievement.
Man, that's such a great point, Bill. You're right. And you're right. That's racially neutral. But if you have a sense of history and where this river began, that you'll realize that there will never be enough money if you are doing the right thing. Because there are people who need to be educated. There are people, you know what I'm saying? There's just so much. And you're right. I think if you live in this insular world, you know, and you think, oh, the car, what else do I need? You're right. And then it's almost like kind of insanity sets in because you say, well, where do I go from here? Mm-hmm. And you have no roadmap. But if you have this roadmap, you say, oh, shoot, I know exactly what I've got to do. You know, and again, that's when it gets back to teaming. I can't do it by myself. You know, we need more people.
William C. Roden is the author of $40 Million Slaves, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of the Black Athlete, published by Crown. He joined me from the studios of NPR West in Los Angeles. Bill, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, Bill, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Tomorrow in Cooperstown, a group of 17 former Negro Leaguers will be inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame, including Effa Manley, who owned the Newark Eagles. But as commentator Martha Ackman reminds us, Manley is not the only female Negro Leaguer worthy of attention.
This week's historic induction of Newark Eagles owner Effa Manley into baseball's Hall of Fame would have thrilled Tony Stone. Stone was the first woman to play professional baseball on men's teams. Like Manley, she made her mark in the Negro Leagues, playing second base for the Indianapolis Clowns in 1953 and the legendary Kansas City Monarchs in 1954. When a young Hank Aaron left the Negro Leagues for the majors in the early 1950s, it was Tony Stone who replaced him. Stone started playing baseball on boys' teams in her hometown of St. Paul when softball was too slow for her. By the time she was a young woman, she was playing semi-pro ball in San Francisco and New Orleans and getting noticed. Then came 1947, and Jackie Robinson integrated baseball. That moment and the subsequent decline of the Negro Leagues made for a unique opportunity for women. As the Negro Leagues began to lose their fan base to the major leagues, club owners looked for new ways to bring crowds through the turnstiles. The Clowns decided to give women a try and tapped Tony Stone to be the gal guardian at second base. While the owners supported her, others did not. Fans would yell, "Why don't you go home and fix your husband some biscuits?" Even a few members of her own team were known to throw the ball to Stone so that players sliding into second would be well positioned to spike her. When Clown's business manager, Bunny Downs, discovered that Stone's teammates were sabotaging her, he announced that he would take action. Any teammate found to intentionally injure Tony Stone, his marquee player, would get a personal escort to the nearest bus station and a ticket home. Like other Negro League players, Stone slept on the team bus night after night because hotels would not open their doors to black players, nor would they feed them. "I was hungry all the time," she said. Stone played two seasons, hit around 250, before the Negro League fell apart and she headed back to California. There was no Branch Rickey in her future. She played ball where she could well into her 60s before arthritis crippled her hands. She died in 1996. Tony Stone was asked once why she put up with all the racism and sexism to play baseball. "Wasn't it obvious," the reporter asked, "that baseball didn't want her?" Stone's answer was simple. "A woman has her dreams too," she said. Perhaps she was thinking of that one Easter Sunday in Omaha in 1953. She was at the plate with a 3-0 count. Satchel Paige raised his big foot and hurled an inside drop pitch right over the plate. Stone connected, smacked it, dead on, over second base and into center. "You're a fool," the first baseman said as she rounded the bag. "The hell I am," she shouted back, and just kept running.
Martha Ackman is a writer who teaches at Mount Holyoke College. She is currently working on a book about Tony Stone. Thank you. If you perchance have a predilection, a penchant, or even a passion for podcasts, please proceed to onlyagame.org and press podcast. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com, and Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting, available at the Implant Dentistry Center at bicon.com, bicon.com. This is NPR, National
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, our own Karen Given rallies in the Maine woods. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
2006 Tour de France winner Floyd Landis said on Thursday regarding a suspicious A sample taken after stage 17 of the race, quote, "I think there's a good possibility I can clear my name," but then he added, "regardless of whether that happens or not, I don't know if this will ever really go away." Will it?
No, it won't. It's already become an international issue. It's already given the more moralistic of our brethren a chance to thump their chest and yell loudly about how right they've been all along. I haven't the faintest idea what's going on here. Floyd seems to have attributed it to everything from the cortisone he took for his degenerating hip to Jack Daniels, and we all know Jack Daniels makes you feel like you've got too much testosterone,
yeah, exactly.
But very rarely does it actually produce it. I don't have any idea what's going on here.
In the deja vu all over again category, Greg Anderson, former personal trainer to Barry Bonds, said nothing to a grand jury this week. How many grand juries have to hear nothing from Mr. Anderson before the prosecution gives up?
Well, the prosecution loses nothing except gas money to get him from his cell to the grand jury room and then back again. I am presuming at this point that there isn't even a bribe being paid here, because the way they've torn Barry Bonds and Greg Anderson's lives apart, I would assume the feds would have found anything he's being paid to keep his mouth shut. The mafia doesn't have this kind of loyalty anymore.
Is it fair to say that this week Maurice Claret, on trial for aggravated burglary and weapons charges, continued to demonstrate the judgment that has characterized his off-field activities for the past couple of years?
Well, you know the old law school saying, Bill, a fool who represents himself has a fool for a client.
the Dan Quayle version of that.
Yeah, well, no, this is, it would be if it wasn't, based in reality. I mean, he's facing very serious legal issues. He has no money, as near as I can tell, because he doesn't pay anybody, including his lawyers. And now he's decided that, having not really approached a degree in any way at Ohio State, he's going to go to law school in 3.5 months and represent himself.
All right, Mr. NASCAR, does the decision of Juan Pablo Montoya to switch from Formula One cars to NASCAR next year change the auto racing world as we know it?
To an extent, there are a serious lack of Juan Pablos in NASCAR, although he may be forced to change his name to Johnny Paul Montoya in order to get sponsors. He still may have to drive some F1 races next year because he's under contract to McLaren. But this is an indication of where you can go to be not only rich, because you can be rich driving Formula One too, but you go to be mega famous. And the way you go to be mega famous is you hand yourself over to NASCAR and let them create the myth around you.
Italian soccer teams Fiorentina, Juventus, and Lazio were involved in various match-rigging adventures and were penalized very heavily, but, as it turns out, only very briefly, until the authorities could figure out how to punish them very lightly instead. Have I got that about right?
Pretty much. I think the authorities in Italian soccer are hoping that the illusion of being severely reprimanded will be enough to turn Fiorentina and Lazio back to the light side. Anyway, they're back in Serie A after the announcement was made. A thunderstorm blew up and drenched all the fans. So, God, who I don't think really has much to do with soccer one way or the other, was clearly not amused by this.
Hamburg SV, a German soccer club, will be giving their fans a new way to assert their everlasting loyalty to the club. And in this case, everlasting is no overstatement.
Many things are not an overstatement in regard to this story. The phrase diehard fans is not an overstatement, because no matter how hard a diehard anyone is, they all die. So now the Hamburg SV is going to open a graveyard 50 yards from the stadium so you can get buried there.
We may soon see another pro football league, Charlie. How will it differ from the ones already operating here and abroad?
Well, it's the AAFL, the All-American Football League, not to be confused with the All-American Football Conference, from which we got the Cleveland Browns way back in the day. They're paying their people $100,000 a year, which is actually real money, which is three times what you make in, say, the Arena League. But the thing is, every player must have graduated to participate, which means you have to have your degree when you sign with this league. Now, the warm-hearted, open-minded liberal in me says this is a great way to get people to finish their degrees. The sports writing cynic in me says this is a great way to produce a lot of worthless diplomas. So let's see.
Great basketball players are versatile. We all know that. They can switch positions or even teams when they have to. I wonder if that explains future Governor Charles Barkley's possible shift from the elephants over to the donkeys.
Charles, shut up. You know, you're not going to run for governor. It's too much work. You're not going to be governor. It's too much work. It will keep you away from the golf course. Get off television. It's a time for serious people, and you're not one of them.
Any chance that in the next World Series of Poker, your bets will be on a player named Mikey?
No, I don't think so, because Mikey's a chimpanzee. See, and I don't bet on animals unless human beings are riding them. They are apparently going to try to put Mikey into the World Series of Poker. I don't know. How does Mikey look with a couple of gold chains and a pair of sunglasses on top of his head?
And finally, Charlie, in the fun is bad department, Scotland Yard has come down on a, quote, seemingly innocent bit of same. Do you agree with the quashing of street wars?
Well, it was obviously going to happen in this nervous age. It's a three-week-long, 24-hour, 7-days-a-week water gun assassination tournament. An innocent bit of fun can escalate with armed officers responding, said a spokesman from Scotland Yard. You damn betcha, I reply.
A squirt gun is no match for a pistol. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Next weekend in Los Angeles, California, and Puerto Escondido, Mexico, the athletes of the 12th Summer X Games will try to carve, grab, grind, plant, rip, shred, sky, and zonk their way to athletic glory. This year, the glossary will be getting a few more entries as the X Games add another new sport, rally racing. From the Maine Forest Rally, Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
It's just after 8 on an otherwise quiet Saturday morning in Berlin, New Hampshire, as a rather unusual parade of brightly painted cars fall into line along a roadside park. For the 58 drivers and their co-drivers of the Maine Forest Rally, the first order of the day is park exposé, which is just a fancy way of saying mandatory autograph session. Travis Pastrana emerges from his team RV almost a half hour later, looking vaguely like a superhero in his royal blue fire suit and bright yellow boots. Pastrana is rally driving's biggest celebrity, better known as the 2005 X Games motocross gold medalist.
Hey, Travis, I'm going to have your picture taken with the mayor of the city.
Oh, how you doing?
So how's it going, sir? Very nice to meet you.
As Pastrana shakes hands with the mayor, kids press in for autographs and proud parents snap photos. But this scene belies the financial realities of rally racing, where teams and drivers spend more on their cars, repairs, and other expenses than they can hope to make in sponsorship and paltry prize money. Everyone, even Pastrana, has to have a day job.
Ironically, if you can call motocross a job, yes, it's a fun job, though, for sure. Right now, U.S. Rally, it's awesome, but everyone does it because they truly have a passion for the sport. And, you know, I still have to make a living, you know, and that's where motocross is great. And, you know, a lot of my sponsors follow me over here, and, you know, hopefully in the years to come, this will become a bigger sport in the States like it is in Europe.
Depending on who you talk to, rally racing is the first or second biggest spectator sport in the world. In the U.S., it's better known as a video game. But Pastrana is sure that the X Games can elevate rally and bring it to a wider audience. After all, it's happened before.
You take Tony Hawk as a skater, skated his whole life, worked construction his whole life, now probably making about, you know, $5 to $8 million a year skating. So, I mean, X Games is huge. When you get the media exposure, sponsors want to help out. And, you know, I think for this sport, as soon as people see it, they're going to... And how can you not like, you know, launching a car, you know, 100 feet through the air and cliffs and trees, and it's really fun.
Rally drivers are known to say if they could just put 2 million people in the passenger seat of their cars, they'd have 2 million new fans. A day earlier, on a small stretch of back road at Concord Pond in Maine, I got a chance to test that theory while strapped into Matt Iorio's 1995 Subaru.
Have you been in a rally car before?
Oh, no, never.
Oh, good. Good.
We're at the shakedown stage, where drivers try their setups on a short section of the course. In this case, it's less than a mile. As in the race itself, cars are sent off one at a time. They compete against the clock, not each other. Matt apologizes for having to take it slow. After all, he doesn't want to break his car before the race even begins. He takes us from 0 to 80 in 13 seconds. Then he says, let's see if we can hit 100. And 10 seconds later, we do, on a dirt road that turns every few hundred feet. The car skids from turn to turn, goes over a jump, and finally comes to rest in line behind the other cars, waiting to be sent off again back toward the start. Iorio compares the ride to a roller coaster, but there's no track, let alone barriers or safety walls. The only thing keeping Iorio's car out of the woods is his skill and the faith that his car will do what he expects it to do.
It always has in the past. Every once in a while you hit a slick bit and it doesn't, and you end up in the woods, but you know, that's only one out of every couple hundred corners, so.
And you're pretty safe up in here. You
know? Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've got the cage. The cage is really well built. You've got all the safety equipment, the helmets. So yeah, it's, considering how many accidents I've been in, I've never been hurt.
Later, at Park Exposé, Matt Iorio says he started rally driving to prove that he's cool. And in the world of rally car, he is. But outside that small and rather secluded world, most people don't even understand what he does.
I always feel like when I'm talking about rally, I start speaking some different language. It's completely its own form of racing and so different from other kinds of motorsports. So it's nearly impossible to explain it, and I really always get so excited talking about it that I start, you know, mumbling it and getting, you know, caught up in things. So I do the worst job of all doing it, but it's tough. It's very tough to get the word out.
I've started saying kind of like Dukes of Hazzard.
Yeah, that's it exactly. I'm gonna have to put a Confederate flag on my roof.
Just like Beau and Luke Duke, two people ride in a rally car, the driver and the co-driver. Teams only get one shot at a particular stretch of dirt road, at least until next year. So the co-driver navigates, letting the driver know when to turn left or right, as well as signaling upcoming blind crests, jumps, hairpin turns, and dips. It's this aspect of the sport that driver Tim Pinisak and his co-driver Natalie Richard find especially intriguing.
I am so dependent upon what Natalie tells me. I set up the car and turn the car before I actually seen the turns. And she's extremely dependent upon me because she doesn't have a brake pedal or steering wheel on her side, right? So she's dependent upon me to make that happen. So we don't get to see the stages. We don't get to see the track and everything. And that's the other challenge of it. It's just, it's edge. It's the extreme side of motorsports. That's what we like about it.
Pinisak runs corporate development and strategy for a technology company, and he sees promise in the growth of rally racing over the past few years. But rally has one obstacle that's hard to overcome.
If you go to a NASCAR event, there's a fixed venue. You go to a football game, it's a fixed venue. There's no fixed venue here. So what you'll see is a lot of people up and down the roads. Those are the fans. That's it. They come watch it.
To that end, organizers are trying to offer more super specials, short, exciting stages where fans can get a sense of the action. Today's super special includes a jump right in front of the spectators at the Mexico Recreation Area. All morning long, drivers have been complaining that the jump is poorly designed, and many take it slow and easy to avoid damaging their cars. But Matt Iorio, feeling sorry for the spectators, shifts into fourth and launches his black and white car into the air. And the only thing missing is the sound of the General Lee's distinctive horn.
Oh,
As the mechanics and rally instructors shake their heads in disapproval, J.B. Nyday, managing director of Rally America, beams. In his mind, this is exactly what fans will want to see when the sport hosts its biggest super special in the Home Depot Center during the X Games.
Nobody's heard of Matt Aureo. You know, they all heard of Travis, but you saw Aureo. Who took the jump big? Who took the jump really big? When they get inside the stadium at X Games, Matt's going to take that jump huge, and all of a sudden, Matt Aureo is going to be a star.
Nyday hopes the X Games will make a star out of the sport, too. But real rallies don't happen in stadiums, with fans safely secured behind barriers. And traditional rally racing is much more difficult to see.
Well, it can be. We just got to find a place to park this rig. It might be better off to go back.
Late in the day, we're back at Concord Pond, finding a place to park along a winding stretch of dirt road. This is where the true rally fan is found, trudging through the woods, smacking mosquitoes, and avoiding poison ivy an hour or more before the race is scheduled to come through.
Roger, roger, W1JM, standing by.
The radio crackles as we finally get close to race time. Former driver and driving instructor Tim O'Neill helps me find a good vantage point, which he promises is as safe as can be. Theoretically, we've chosen a spot where we can see the cars skid around a left turn, power through the straightaway, and then slide over a blind right turn at the crest of a hill. My jaw drops as the first car passes in the road 10 feet in front of me. Try to look cool. Maybe no one will notice.
Look at her. Is that what you expected? Not?
No.
Don't you worry. We have spare underwear for everybody.
Watching car after car go by, I try to forget that rally racing has the reputation as a dangerous sport. For the spectators. After a while, I get used to the rumbling feeling in my gut as a car speeds past, flinging rocks and gravel. And I begin to feel the excitement the drivers find so addictive. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Just a good old boy, never meaning no harm. Beats all you never saw, been in trouble with the law since the day they was born. Straighten the curve, yeah.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Simon Wood. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view Karen Given's rally photos, learn more about $40 million slaves, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from road rally driver Matthew Johnson, who admits that he takes his work home and that he takes it shopping as well.
Or if I'm in the grocery store, pushing the grocery store cart around in the aisles, I'm always taking the race line, always sliding the grocery cart around like I'm driving a car.
Clean up in aisle 7, Mr. Road Rally has taken out the applesauce again. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
That's just a little bit more than the law will allow. I'm a good old boy, you know my mama loved me, but you don't understand, they keep her showing.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston and from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities on the web at WKKF.org. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation with a new website at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.